agreement is, what's the extent of their powers? And do they, can they exercise power when the tribes themselves don't hold any land, when the land is held by native corporations, which are simply private corporations under state law? I think these are the questions that surround sovereignty. I intend to deal with this in my report. There have been many views expressed on the subject, and I think that some of them must be right and a lot of others must be wrong. But if you start off with the basics, nobody argues that there is no such thing as the native sovereignty. The argument is, to what extent are native people, Indian tribes in Alaska entitled to exercise that sovereignty today? That is the real question, it seems to me. But before I go any farther, maybe we should see if others would like to speak. Mr. Warren.
Yes, sir.
Oh, sorry.
Well, the way I...
Could just, we'll get Eileen, who's been good enough to patch up my coat before it falls.
The way I understand sovereignty
for the record,
is... Lonnie Strong Hutch. The way I understand sovereignty is the right to govern ourselves. And I'd like to pose the question, where does the federal government get their sovereignty? From the people. The Constitution of the United States says, we the people. They've got their right to govern from the people they govern. And we give the right to govern to whoever we elect as our village council members. And I say we have, and one person's opinion, I say we have the right to extend our sovereignty as far as we choose to. And it's a decision that we make ourselves and not one that anybody else can inflict upon us.
Well, I think that you're quite right about the origins of sovereignty. Maybe it is worthwhile remembering that just last year, President Reagan issued a statement from the White House in which he said that his government, the government of the United States of America, did recognize the sovereignty of Indian tribes in the Lower 48, and he said that the federal government would deal with the Indian tribes of the Lower 48 on a government-to-government basis. Now, the argument is, well, will they do that in Alaska? That's one of the things that, as Mr. King and others have said, seems to be one of the big issues.
The other thing my Uncle Edward mentioned earlier about that Public Law 280, I've read that law and I've heard about it, and it's a law where the state of Alaska was extended jurisdiction over the Indian villages in Alaska. But who extended that jurisdiction was the federal government. And when the federal government extended that jurisdiction, they in themselves only had concurrent jurisdiction with the tribes in Alaska, because there was already existing, before the federal government became into existence, already tribes governing themselves in Alaska. So how can then the federal government extend jurisdiction to the state when they themselves had only concurrent jurisdiction? So I would presume to say that the best the state can assume is concurrent jurisdiction, if any.
Well, I think that it's fair to say that nobody claims now that Public Law 280 did any more than extend concurrent jurisdiction to the state. But the question is not without its own difficulties. But you have in Alaska a tribal government and tribal court at Metlakatla. It's not as if these things had never been heard of in this state. You had a case decided here in Klukwan a few years ago in which a federal judge here in Alaska decided that tribal laws were still in force in this village. So these are deep waters, but I'll paddle around on the surface for a while. Yes, Mr. Warren and then Mr. King. Did you want to just be seated there and Eileen could...
Okay. Ed Warren. I'd like to expand on my earlier statement about the non-depreciable asset called land. Not too long ago, there was a computer analysis made by the tribes of the lower states that, and they concluded that they, in gathering their information about Indian lands, they concluded that 28% of the land in the U.S., continental U.S., are owned by native tribes. To them, it represents some significant economic and political power. And
28% of the land?
Of lands owned in the United States, of the United U.S., continental U.S. is...
If you take away federal and state land and talk about privately owned land?
Tribal lands.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this is significant for them to say, and to me, for anyone to perceive and begin talking economic activities. Now, what I'm leading up to is that unless we get a taste of some kind of action or power, we're going to limit ourselves. In the case of Klukwan Inc., Klukwan Inc.'s liquidating assets to make distributions to shareholders. Now, what we see is that the shareholders are getting the feel of purchasing power. Without it, if we waited until the corporation made technically a return to earnings and a profit, and it would be maybe in the next generation. But because the corporation, the board of directors are liquidating assets and transferring the funds to the shareholders, we see the shareholders' self-image changing. They get to feel the purchase of the power within money. Now, we can do a lot of things when we directors of boards, as small as we are, to help our shareholders. There are some land base needs to be addressed, and it has to be done through political power. And where do you get the power? From the mighty dollar. There are communities like Haines needs a land base, Wrangell community, Petersburg community, Ketchikan community. And there's a group of natives, shareholders, called the Sea Alaska Members at Large. With today's information, we probably can arrive at one conclusion that is no one thought that the members at large would be a huge number. There are a lot of people, members at large at Sea Alaska, Anchorage and Haines and the Puget Sound area and Washington State and San Francisco Bay area. I think the members are, since the numbers are so large, it should be addressed. And the land base would probably recommend as an individual is that it can take in from the land that Sea Alaska already owns. To do anything else, it's going to take U.S. Congress. To do it internally, why shouldn't the Haines, Wrangell, Petersburg, and Ketchikan and members at large not have a land base? They have title. They have a membership to Sea Alaska anyway. Like everyone else, I have a long list, but I think I better stop while the.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Warren. Mr. King, did you want to add something?
But your folks are talking about sovereignty. What I wanted to say was, I believe it was Judge Stewart on the last court we were holding in Juneau concerning the Frog Cows. After 2.5 years of fight, Judge Stewart, I believe it was him that said, I'm just sitting here. I'm just listening. I have no power over Indian law. Their law is their law. That's what he told of both sides. I have no power. Indian law is Indian law. That's all I want to say.
Thank you, Mr. King.
My name is Tony Strong. I'm from here in Clockwan. I wanted to say a few things about something I was hoping somebody here would have talked about, and I know that there are more people in Clockwan who would be able to do a better job than I could do on this. Perhaps they're not here in town, or they didn't hear about this hearing. But one of the things I wanted to have on record with the Alaska Native Review Commission is the history of how Clockwan is participating in the Claim Settlement Act. The history of Clockwan, of course, is long. The name Clockwan itself, as I understand it, means the town that has been here since time immemorial. That just a little underlined sovereignty issue. Initially, when Clockwan was asked on whether or not it wanted to participate in the Claim Settlement Act, it said no. It said, we don't want it. At the time I'd heard about that, I was in college out in New Jersey. And I was talking to my mom, and I said, what happened? She said, I don't know. She said, well, maybe you could find out. So I came up. I took some time off from school and flew up from New Jersey. And the next day I walked down and talked to some of the council members. Why aren't we participating? Took some time. They told me what happened, and some of them got mad at me, thought I was up here being paid by somebody else to become participants in the Claim Settlement Act. They got mad at me, misunderstanding what my intentions were. I mean, I was able to come up here because I was working for an airline at the time, too, so I got free trip, just about a $7 round trip. So, I found out from people on the council on why we weren't participating, why we had said, this was in, I think it was in 80, I'm sorry, in 72, December of 72, why we weren't going to participate. Clockwan has approximately 893 acres of land that it had prior to the Claim Settlement Act. It had it as a presidential proclamation. It was an executive order reserve. It was never a reservation created by Congress, but it was an executive reserve, which was subsequent to that, acknowledged by Congress, which put it under the whole reservation kind of atmosphere or laws of the lower 48. That 893 acres was held in trust by the United States government, both surface and subsurface, which meant that the people of Tlokwan were able to have all of the rights that go with that surface and subsurface rights that was going to be held for their benefit by the United States government. The act, if we were to participate in it, would say that we would get 23,040 acres, like all the other villages here in Southeast Alaska. And the problem that the people in the leadership here in Tlokwan saw was that that 23,040 acres was to be selected on land contiguous to the village, which meant it had to be bordered on the village land already. And the problem that that presented is that all the land around Tlokwan was already patented out to the state to private individuals under mining claims. Mining claims were being used as a way for timber industry to get title to land or lay a claim to land so they can go off and take off the timber, not even concerned about mining out anything. The result is that the land around Tlokwan was the surface value of the land was mostly gone. We'd have to take it away from the state or take it away from private individuals without any surface value left to it. Good night, Charlie. Well, the problem with that was that we would get the 23,000, even if we had the land around us, we would get the 23,040 acres without any subsurface estate. During all that time, we had land here that we had been told over time that it was the value of the land was the subsurface, which had iron in it. There was a lease on it that is held by several different companies. U.S. Steel was one, then they subleased it to Mitsubishi, and then Mitsubishi subleased or sold the lease back to U.S. Steel. That there was an estimate of value of that iron ore. That estimate was somewhere, it varied depending on who you were talking to, somewhere between $9 million and $54 million in value of subsurface. In the subsurface estate here in Tlokwan of 893 acres. Tlokwan was being told that they would be able to select land in Tlokwan in the Chilkat Valley, which had very little surface value, and they wouldn't get any kind of subsurface value at all. So what they were looking at was that they would get their land taken away from them, and they would get 893 acres minus the subsurface value, minus that potentially $9 million to $54 million worth of iron ore underneath it. And the land that they would be able to select would be on the mountaintops around here. So why participate? We would only stand to lose everything. So they said, no, we don't want it. It took some time to find that out. Well, as a result of some arguments that went back and forth and a lot of work that went in by a lot of different people here in Tlokwan and people living outside of Tlokwan. My uncle Edward was involved in it. My family was involved in it. Some people here in Tlokwan were involved in it. Some people in Haines were involved in it. We became participants in the Claim Settlement Act through the omnibus amendments that were passed in 1975 and signed into law in 1976. The omnibus amendments said that Tlokwan people would be able to participate in the Claim Settlement Act under certain conditions. One of those conditions would be that 893 acres of land that was the former reserve would be passed right through Tlokwan Inc. It would not be held by Tlokwan Incorporated, but it would be land that Tlokwan Inc. would receive as part of its 23,040 acres fee simple land, but they would subtract that 893 acres and transfer or quiet title language of the Act says quiet title to Chilkat Indian Village. So that Klukwan or the Chilkat Indian Village now holds the subsurface estate and the surface estate for 893 acres in fee simple title. It's not land held in trust by the United States government.
But what is the entity that holds the land? Is it an IRA council?
Chilkat Indian Village is an IRA council formed as pursuant to the 1936 amendments to the Indian Reorganization Act.
And the land was transferred from the secretary to Klukwan Inc. to Klukwan Indian Village.
That's correct. Essentially, that's the story. Klukwan Incorporated was permitted to select lands in another section of Southeast Alaska. They found and selected land in Long Island, which is in the southern part of Southeast, almost the very tip of the southern part of Southeast, just above the Canadian border, your hometown, home state. There's a couple other problems that I wanted to touch base on. I don't know if I have any solution to the problems that I've identified. I really like to present some solution when I'm talking about a problem, and that is a problem that I've talked with people in Southeast Alaska about, people in this community of Klukwan and the Chilkat Valley, and that's the allotment problem. There were people, I mean, the 1906 Allotment Act, I'm sure you've heard about it over time. There are people in this valley who have laid claim to certain property, had an application in, and just haven't been able to have their allotments followed through on. And I don't think that the Claim Settlement Act addressed that problem. If it did, it didn't do it sufficiently to be able to resolve the problem for the people in the communities. Another thing that I've talked with some people in this community about, and I wish those people were here to give this testimony themselves, is that when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed, it was during that whole process of negotiating with the federal government, Southeast Alaska was initially going to be left out of the Claims Settlement Act. And the reason for it is that Southeast Natives, quote unquote, had made their settlement with the federal government by having the Tlingit and Haida people having sued the United States government and won a judgment that was, the judgment was made in 58, and I think the distribution was made a lot later. Matter of fact, one of the people who kept the Tlingit and Haida Central Council alive since, I can't remember when it was, 1929, was when the Alaska Native Brotherhood here in Haines said that we will go after a settlement. And the only way we could have a judgment, we'd have a group of people who would be clients to, or people who would be bringing the suit on, that judges or the lawyers could bring the suit on behalf of, was an organization. So the Tlingit and Haida people of Southeast, or Tlingit and Haida tribes of Southeast Alaska was formed. And then in 1936, there was an act passed by Congress authorizing the suit. This guy standing up there in the middle, Andrew Hope, the first, is the person who kept the Tlingit and Haida Indian tribes of Alaska in existence, and they just did it on the coattails of A and B meetings every year. But I mean, that's a lot more history than is necessary for my point. That judgment really involved Tongass National Forest, and Alaska. The rest of the Alaska Natives were up in the northern part of Southeast or northern part of Alaska. They did not include Southeast Alaska. What was not included in that Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and what was not in, was Southeast Alaska lands, partly because of that judgment, but that judgment included only those Tongass National Forest lands. The lands in this valley the lands that go from the Canadian border north of Tongass National Forest all the way out to the coastline are not included in the Tongass National Forest. There's approximately 2.6 million acres of land that I don't know if the Southeast Native people have received compensation for. And I, my personal feeling is that unless the Act says that it specifically identifies these lands down here, then I say that we haven't been compensated for it, and it still belongs. I mean, there's been no taking in the sense. And I don't see any having no taking of that land that still belongs to the people who owned it before. I mean, I can go clear back from the history of pre-contact to now to talk about how I arrive at that conclusion, but you know that goes in with sovereignty issues as well. I don't have anything else to add.
Do you have anything? Could I just ask you if you had anything to add to what Mr. King said about the grave sites? I think he said on the river front in Haines. Do you happen to know anything more about that?
There are some. I suspect that some people in Haines will talk about the problem.
I see, tomorrow.
And I could give you some idea of what they'll be talking about. The people in Haines, I don't know how to describe it except for the people here in the audience. Main Street in Haines, one that goes straight from when you get to the border of Haines, that takes you right down into the harbor, and the other side of the road, that other highway that takes you all the way out to Port Chilcoot, that sort of a V that takes you into town. All of that land belonged to the Native community, very specifically belonged to the Native community, although all of it prior to contact belonged to them. That Native community had agreed to transfer use and occupancy to the Presbyterian Church some time ago. I don't remember what date it was. That they would be used to educate natives and that it would be used for the church purposes. That part of that agreement and the understanding of that native community down there was that once those two uses were no longer in effect, land was supposed to automatically revert back to the native people in Haines. Well, what happened to it? I mean, right now it's got the post office on it. It's got the businesses on it that are sitting on it. It's got public school on it. It's got the moose. I mean, the Elks Club. It's got Alascom, or which was Alascom. It's still Alascom, isn't it? It used to be RCA. It's got all kinds of other owners. In other words, how did they get title to the land? Nobody's answered that question. And who's compensated those native people down there? I think those are the lands that Richard was talking about at the very front of that, right on the border or right on the street that goes down along the between Port Chilcoot and Haines. We drove over it today. Is on the left-hand side, coming from Port Chilcoot to Haines, is a grave site. And there are some tombstones up there, and there are a lot of names of people who, native people, who have been buried there. The historic sites, by the way, there's not been a whole lot of transfers. Matter of fact, I witnessed at the Sea Alaska annual meeting the transfers of historical sites and grave sites. Was the very first transfers were being made at the Sea Alaska annual meeting this year. Yeah, although that they've been working on it for quite some time and fairly diligently, as I understand. I mean, that means Bureau of Land Management. Did you have?
No, that's
okay.
Thank you, Mr. Strong. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warner. Thank you, ma'am. Well, would anyone else like to say anything this evening? We'll be meeting at Haynes at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, expect to hear from the people living down that way. But, yes, certainly. Any folks from Clukwan that would like to come to the meeting at Haynes tomorrow morning, and any of you who would like to come, please do. You will all be welcome. I want to thank you for the testimony you've given this evening. It's been very interesting and very helpful. We've had 12 people testify at this hearing tonight, which I think is very good, and I'm certainly pleased. And I can tell you that I will continue traveling around the state and holding meetings like this until early in the new year, and then I will be preparing my report and sending copies to you here in Clukwan. And in it, I will make my recommendations about these questions, and they are difficult ones that have been raised, but I will do my best to make sure that my recommendations conform to what you have expressed as your own views on the matter. Not, they won't reflect just what Clukwan said, but what everybody said at all these meetings throughout the state. And so I want to thank you again, and on behalf of those who traveled with me, and on my own behalf, let me thank you again for that potluck supper. We really did enjoy it. So the meeting stands adjourned, and I hope we'll see some of you at least in Haynes tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.
We were at June